First the saber dance, and then the introduction and dance of the elders from the Gyna Ballet Suite by Aram Khachaturian, which was a nice follow-up to the preceding piece, which was the Khachaturian Symphony No. 3. This has been Valerie Jean here at WUSB. I'll be back in 3 weeks with another classical program here at 90.1. Jim Wayne will be here next week, and Dave Brown the week after that. Stay tuned now for Stardate, and then after that, Eric Corley with Brain Damage here at Long Island's first station of the 90s, WUSB, Stony Brook.
Stardate November 18th. The naked eye can see farther than you know, to the twin of our own Milky Way galaxy, the great galaxy in the constellation Andromeda. This object is the nearest large spiral galaxy to the Milky Way. It's the only exterior galaxy visible without optical aid from the northern hemisphere. To see it, you need a very dark sky, one free from city lights and moonlight. And since the moon is now waning, the evenings will soon be dark enough to let you glimpse Andromeda. A prominent star pattern called the Great Square of Pegasus can guide you to the constellation Andromeda. The square is large. Its sides are roughly the size of your hand as seen at arm's length. The constellation Andromeda consists of a simple line of stars extending from the square toward the northeast. The Great Square and the constellation Andromeda together look something like a kite with a tail, a large pattern almost directly overhead in the November evening sky. To find the galaxy, begin by locating the square. Start from the northeast corner and let your eyes roam diagonally away from the square up among Andromeda's stars. To the naked eye, the mighty Andromeda galaxy looks like an elongated fuzzy star. But the haze is really the combined light of hundreds of billions of stars in the shape of a giant pinwheel. There are billions of spiral galaxies in the universe. This one is our nearest neighbor and the most distant thing visible to the naked eye. It's so far away that the light you see it by left the galaxy more than 2 million years ago. This is Stardate, our writer-producer, Deborah Bird. Stardate and Stardate Magazine are produced by the McDonald Observatory. And for the McDonald Observatory, I'm Joel Block.
And you're not.
Hello.
I'm sad.
I'm sad.
I want to go down.
Okay. Are you happy? I don't wanna pee.
I don't wanna go to school.
I don't wanna eat. You were mean to me.
I'm sad. I want to go to school.
I'm sad.
I'm happy.
I don't want to take a nap.
I'm sad.
I don't want to go down.
I don't want to take a nap.
I don't want to eat.
I want to go home.
I want to go.
I'm so tired.
I'm hungry.
I'm happy.
I'm happy. I don't want to go down. I don't want to watch a movie.
I don't want to go home.
I want to watch a movie.
I want to take a nap.
I want to do that.
I'm sad.
I'm happy.
I want to go to school.
Okay.
I'm hungry. I'm happy.
I don't want to pee.
I don't want to go to Peter's house.
I don't want to go.
You were mean to me.
Are you happy?
I don't want to play. I don't want to talk on the phone.
I don't want to go home.
I'm so tired.
Hey.
Thank you.
hear a bulbulbous sound. Hollow and valley and shadow and dimple and hill. Glisten and glimmer and shimmer and sparkle and still.
About enough of that. Not that I don't like it. It's great. I mean, this is the most amazing record I've found in a long time. Actually, I found it a long time ago when I was over in Amsterdam. I was going through a record store. I went through record stores all over the place. They're always interesting. And except in East Berlin. East Berlin, they were, you know, just all these classical records that for some reason you didn't feel like listening to, and that was it. But this is a record from Roger Waters, and a guy named Ron Geeson, who, if anybody knows more about him, please give a call and tell me. It's from 1970, and I've never seen it over here in the United States. It's called The Body. It's all this music. It's sort of like another version of The Wall, sort of a more human version of The Wall. We heard Our Song, Seashell and Stone, and right now I think we're hearing Red Stuff Ripe. All the ones that are kind of weird are written by Ron Geeson, and all the ones with words are Roger Waters. And, you know, I think it's really neat, because on the other side there's a song called Breathe. And if you know Pink Floyd, on Dark Side of the Moon there's a song called Breathe. It's a different song, but you can see how this one led him to write that one. And you can also see how a bunch of things inspired him to do other pieces. It's got a picture of, I guess, one of those anatomy dummies on the front cover. And all the songs are about the body in some way. Breathe, Body Transport, Piddle in Perspex, Embryonic Womb Walk, Mrs. Throat Goes Walking. Yeah, you know, things like that. And maybe we'll hear a little bit more from it later on. You know, why not? We can do whatever we want right here. Also got a bunch of other musical things I felt like bringing in, because I'm in kind of a musical mood, but not at the moment. At the moment, I want to find out something, and maybe you folks can help me find this out. And it sounds simple enough, okay? But folks around here don't wear watches. It's a fact. I mean, those that do wear watches, we don't trust them anyway. We never did. But I don't wear a watch. In fact, even at my home, I don't know what time it is, because none of the clocks really tell the same time. That's the problem we have here right now. We don't know what time it is. We really don't know what time it is. You see, last week we had a power outage. You know, it's one of those little features the university throws our way sometimes. And ever since then, all the clocks in this place have been telling radically different times. Now, it's around 10 o'clock. That's all I can tell you. It's around 10 o'clock, and I can sort of feel that in my system. But what time it really is beyond me. I don't know what time it really is. And you would say, well, why don't you just call up and find out what the time is, you big stupid moron? Oh, okay, fine. Well, if I pick up the phone and try calling the time in what might be called an emergency situation, that's what I get, okay? That's what I get, this damn noise. You see, in its infinite wisdom, the university and the Rome phone people decided that it would be best for us not to call the time ever. So this is one of those occasions where we have no idea what time it is. So, if you can help by calling us up, except this presents another problem, because how do I know you're telling the truth? You're going to tell me it's 5 after 6 or something, and how am I going to know? it's a dilemma, you know. We may never know the real time again at this radio station. You know, you would also say, all right, why don't you turn on an AM radio and hear the radio station say what time it is, you know, the news radio station. You can't do that either because that same phone system tears apart the AM dial and you can't hear any AM stations on campus. It's really a weird situation. So I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. If anyone can help, maybe you have a long-distance number to call to get the time. Kind of stupid, I know, but what can you do? Our phone number is 632-6901. It's close to 10 o'clock, somewhere around there. My name is Eric Corley. The program is Brain Damage. You can see why. And we're here until, about 12 o'clock, I guess, tonight. And we'll sort of see what happens. No takers. Nobody wants to tell me the time it is? Fine. Okay, we'll just go right into this communist news program. Then we'll come back and play some more strange music and take your phone calls and complain about other things, too.
This is your program, Moscow Mailbag.
Not affiliated with the Columbia Broadcasting System.
First, let's see what kind of questions we have today. Would I need my passport to travel between Soviet republics? Are there any restrictions on the ownership of shortwave receivers? How is the public transport system in your country run? These questions and more are lined up in today's mailbag. Our first letter today comes from Gary Viraldi of Owen Sound, Ontario, Canada. How many staff members do you have to answer listeners' letters? Whenever I hear from you, it seems to be Yevgenia Stepanova's signature on the letter. Poor Yevgenia. I hope she's not the only one who has to lick all those envelopes. You must get hundreds of letters each week. Anyway, my thanks to Mrs. Stepanova.
Well, if poor Yevgenia Stepanova had to do all the licking of envelopes in her 40-year-long career with the letters department, she would have undoubtedly consumed bucketfuls of glue by now. Thank God letters are sealed by a sealing machine and no licking is involved. Actually, in addition to our veteran, Yevgenia Stepanova, two other members are involved in answering your mail. And believe me, you keep them busy, too. Yevgenia has now retired, but she continues to come in and lend a hand whenever there is an avalanche of mail from North America. And together with the World Service of Radio Moscow, we do get hundreds of letters each week. I'll pass on your thanks to Yevgenia Stepanova. She'll be touched.
And now a question from Michael Ossi of State College, Pennsylvania. Are there any restrictions other than price on ownership of shortwave receivers in the USSR?
There are absolutely no restrictions on owning shortwave receivers, and I don't remember of any since World War II. And that time, yes, all shortwave radios had to be turned into the local authorities for safekeeping until the end of the war. The measure was necessitated by the need, the authorities said, to prevent the spread of Nazi propaganda. After the war, most of the shortwave receivers were returned to their owners, but some were lost during those hard times or simply stolen. There have been no restrictions since then. Most radios, in fact, are locally made, but some imports have been also available. I know of radio buffs who have preserved vintage World War II U.S.-made RCA systems, which are still operational. These days, the price of shortwave sets isn't a problem. Most families can afford to buy any receiver, however expensive. The problem with radio sets, like with many other common items, is whether you find them in the store when you want them. With the latest wave of consumer frenzy, such goods as radio equipment have almost completely disappeared from the store shelves, and all you can find is either bulky equipment or something hopelessly old-fashioned. It is not that fewer radios are being produced, it's just that people seem eager to buy up whatever is available as a hedge against inflation. And some families indeed have more radio sets, players, TV sets than they really need for their personal use.
And does the government still jam foreign shortwave services?
No, not any longer. Since last December, all jamming has stopped. In fact, the Voice of America, long viewed as inveterate and irredeemable bogey, has now a correspondent posted in the Soviet capital. That's part of the policy of Glasnost that has taken firm root in this country.
We have a couple of questions from Tom Moore, who makes his home in Orpington, Kent, Great Britain. Would I need my British passport to travel between Soviet republics?
No, not in passing from one republic to another, but you will need your passport when you travel in the USSR. You have to produce it for registration at each hotel you stay in. That's a rule that everyone has to follow, Soviet or foreign nationals. I personally feel this sort of thing is way out of date with the latest changes taking place in this country. Certainly, you have to have your passport to enter the country, but I don't see any need to preserve the rule of producing your official passport to stop at a hotel. And that's how it will be eventually, I'm sure.
I'm told your national anthem talks about an insoluble union of free republics. Is this true?
Yes, the anthem contains a line about the indestructible union of free republics. True, Article 72 of the USSR Constitution says that each union republic shall retain the right freely to secede from the USSR. No republic has ever invoked this provision, which was also included in previous Soviet constitutions. The next article, 73, however, says that the central government has jurisdiction over state boundaries, and another provision says territorial changes are subject to ratification by the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. I might say, however, that legal constitutional amendments are imminent.
Next, a letter from Ronald Wall of New Jersey. If the United States plans to go alone on a voyage to Mars, it would be a tremendous strain on the budget. If the Soviet Union plans a lone voyage to Mars, it would be a strain on your budget. Why don't both countries plan a joint voyage to Mars and back?
That's a reasonable question. There are wide-ranging estimates of the possible costs of a manned flight to Mars. A Soviet space official, obviously interested in future space research, has put the cost at $25 billion. That's what it cost the United States to mount the Apollo program. Other estimates indicate a Mars mission would cost a whopping $100 billion. And that is also the amount it would cost to deploy the first echelon of the Star Wars program. I think it would certainly be better to spend the money on a mission to Mars rather than put it into military spending.
Is the Soviet Union prepared to cooperate in this mission with the United States?
During the Soviet-American summit in Moscow last year, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev proposed to President Reagan cooperating in this endeavor. Although there has been no official response, last year the two sides did sign an agreement that calls for resumption of Soviet-American cooperation in space research. For the time being, each side is going it alone as far as a manned mission to Mars is concerned. Soviet and American space officials are making plans for unmanned missions to Mars to take place before the end of the century, hoping to retrieve samples of Martian soil. And only sometime in the next century would it be possible to dispatch men to that planet. The timing of the missions is thought to be somewhere between 2005 and 2025, so there is plenty of time before that. But many aspects of the future flights have to be collated and coordinated right now if the two sides decide to make it a joint venture. For example, the specifications of the future Martian landing module will depend on what part of the planet will be chosen for the mission, its polar areas or the equator.
Now, many people in the United States think it would be a waste of money to send such a mission to Mars. Isn't there such a feeling in the Soviet Union?
Some people in the Soviet Union feel that way, too. There are enough problems as it is right now in the Soviet Union. Not the least of them are economic problems, and many people object to spend so much money on a scientific project whose future benefits are obscure. And there is a strong opposition to such costly research in the Soviet legislature with its newly acquired clout. But then there is perhaps an equally strong lobby in favor of the Mars project. Is that flight worth the money it would cost? One strong proponent of the project says, imagine if in her time the Spanish Queen got stingy and withheld the money necessary for Columbus's voyages. Who would have discovered the America then and when?
Dan Coffey Jr., who is 12 years of age and lives in Maine, has written us to say that he will soon be studying the USSR in school. His specific sphere of interest is education. What is the educational system like in the Soviet Union?
Judging from your age, your sphere of interest is our school education. Well, basically, there are two types of schools in the Soviet Union. There are eight-year schools and secondary schools with a 10 or 11-year curriculum. They correspond approximately to your junior high and high schools, respectively. All Soviet schools are uniform. They have the same curriculum, the same classes, and their main philosophy is to give students the basic of knowledge in as many areas as possible. And secondly, to give them some work habits and some work training. There are some good schools, some excellent schools with superior teaching staff and equipment, and there are some schools poorly equipped, both in teaching staff and tools. But basically, they all stick to the same curriculum. There's a limited number of what we call specialized schools, which are not necessarily privileged or elite schools, but they do specialize in some particular field of knowledge, such as the fine arts, mathematics, chemistry, or foreign language training.
Dan also asks, what are some basic facts about your school curriculum?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that classes are 6 days a week, except Sunday. Each lesson lasts for 45 minutes. By way of experiment, a five-day school week has been introduced in a number of schools. The school year begins on September 1st and lasts till the end of May. The year is divided into four terms, semesters, with vacations after each one. The longest is the summer vacation, lasting about 2 months. The latest innovation is a gradual switching over from a 10-year cycle to an 11-year one. The basic idea is to start early from the age of 6 and leave school early with an extra school year, of course, and presumably extra knowledge. And there's been a heavy emphasis of late on computer training in schools. The effort to computerize the Soviet school system began in 1985, and we have yet to go a long way toward that goal. Last September, the Soviet Union signed an agreement with an American corporation, Phoenix Group International, to jointly produce personal computers for school training. By 1995, the joint venture is expected to manufacture 100 to 150,000 computers a year.
Next, a question comes from Ms. Anna Johnson of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. An average automobile costs in the United States about $8,000 and about $10,000 Canadian dollars. Gasoline is freely available and sells for about 40 cents a liter. On the other hand, the public transport systems here are extremely poor, and thus an automobile is almost a necessity of life. I would be interested to know how things are in the Soviet Union in this regard.
The situation here is quite the opposite. While the automobile is basically viewed as a luxury, public transport is a necessity of life. An average car that you would probably consider a down-to-earth subcompact costs about 8,000 rubles, over 12,000 U.S. dollars. But money does not seem to be the problem. Lots of people have the money to buy, and the problem is where and how to buy a car. Even second-hand cars are in high demand, particularly if they can still run for a while, and the situation in the private automobile market is not likely to improve until the mid-90s at the earliest, our economists say. Gasoline here is somewhat more expensive than in your country, but apparently it is now in short supply because many gas stations are either closed down or out of gas at the moment. On the other hand, public transport seems to run more or less smoothly, and the fares are low. 5 kopecks for inside-city travel, regardless of the distance. And although public means of transportation do not provide the comfort you might want, you can still get wherever you want and get there fast.
And stay alive. And there we end this edition of Moscow Mailbag. This program is on the air every Saturday, Sunday, and Wednesday at the same time on these frequencies. If you want to contribute your own question, just drop us a line. The address is the North American Service of Radio Moscow, Moscow, the USSR.
FCC regulations require that I tell you that dropping lines with Soviets is a violation of many different things at the same time, so please be careful when you do things like that, and be safe. Right, that was Radio Moscow here on WUSB Stony Brook on Brain Damage, and it was brought to you by nobody in particular. And this is the sound of Radio Moscow going backwards at a high speed. Yeah, well, enough of that. We are celebrating here tonight. We certainly are. We're very happy and pleased, and well, we usually are anyway. But first of all, I want to say thanks to, well, I wasn't sure if it was, I didn't write this down, unfortunately. It was either Mike and Andrew from Bellport, or it was Mike and Anthony from Bellport. So I guess the way around it is to thank all three of them, Mike, Anthony, and Andrew. Thanks for calling from Bellport and telling us that it's 10:15. However, it's 10:29 right now, so I don't know what you're trying to pull. We do know what time it is now. All the clocks in the station have been set, and 10:29 is the time. And we are taking your phone calls at 632-6901. Thing is, though, you have to call in before I say that, because when I see that there's no phone calls, I just say, hey, let's go to our next feature, which in this case happens to be music.
Penny Lane, there is a bar showing photographs.
There you go, the extra horns and Penny Lane. We have the rare special version there. And, yes, no problem, no problem. We can bring that kind of thing to you. 632-6901 is our telephone number. And I mentioned before that we were celebrating, but I never said what we were celebrating. And, well, the fact of the matter is, the glorious fact of the matter is that today is the first Saturday in which we can call the Soviet Union directly. Isn't it amazing? You used to have to go through an operator. But this week they changed things. This week, Glasnost suddenly hit us full in the face. And All the restrictions to call the Soviet Union have been lifted. So, to celebrate this phenomenal event, we're going to call the Soviet Union direct. Isn't that fun? We don't know who we're going to call. We're just going to find a number. But I need help. I need help from our listeners on this because, well, there's nothing worse than waking up a Soviet in the middle of the night, right? And we don't want to do that. Right now in Moscow, I believe it's something like 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning, or something like that. And, you know, it's Sunday, and I don't know. I don't want to get anybody upset. So I figure it's probably best to call somebody on the East Coast or in the eastern part of the country, Siberia or, you know, any part of the country over there. Now, what I need from anyone out there is to go to a map and tell me the name of what looks like a major city in that part of the country. So find a world map, find me the name of a major city in the Soviet Union that's away on the other side of the country, you know, sort of where China is and all that kind of thing. Give us a call here at 632-6901 and be prepared to spell that name for us. Give us a call on the air. We'll take your call right after this next feature, and then we will use that information to call up that particular place and hopefully say hello to somebody. But we might just confuse people, but then again, that's fine too. We like doing that.
Germany Today. People, places, and politics. The arts, too. From Bonn, Berlin, and New York. Timely coverage of the events and issues inside Germany that are important to America.
This is Germany Today, November 1989. I'm Lee Murphy in New York with Peggy Trautman, Alfred Schroeder, Joseph Fleming, Catherine Field, and Owen Levy bringing us direct reports from overseas. Bonn announces Poland aid package of more than $1 billion. Several West German leaders openly call for East German political reform as new East Berlin chief takes over. Who are the German refugees from the East? We have a snapshot of the typical transition. Also, a special section on IBM's operations in West Germany, its strengths and weakness. Are the Alps truly endangered? Environmentalists think so, and one offers advice for the future. Hamburg, home of Germany's littlest theater, may soon boast Europe's largest. Details in a moment on Germany Today. The prospects are mind-boggling for the world at large. Depolarization and detente after decades of Cold War. And headiest of all is the thought of democracy now being harvested on the other side of what until so recently was called the Iron Curtain, harvested like a late bumper crop of wheat. But then there's the concern about possible destabilization and the need to avert it as Eastern Europeans quicken their pace and broaden their goals in a virtual race toward political freedom. No one is more aware of both the upside and downside to all this change than those closest to the action. Apparently, the largest Poland aid package to date, for instance, comes from West Germany, which reportedly is ready to pledge $1 billion to $1.5 billion in loan guarantees to the recently elected Solidarity government in Warsaw. Bonn is not alone, however. The French reportedly will offer the Poles $642 million in aid, and Congress is considering at least two assistance packages ranging from some $800 million to $900 million plus dollars. When most Americans think about what's happening these days in East Europe, chances are they see pictures of East Germans clamoring to make it west to the sorts of freedoms they simply didn't have under the regime of an aging communist leader. And now that he's out,
a hardliner took the place of a die-hard communist when Egon Krenz replaced 77-year-old Erich Honecker as party and government leader in East Germany. Despite the growing doubts here in West Germany that the change in leadership also means giving in to the demand of a skyrocketing number of East Germans who call for democracy, freedom, and human rights, the Social Democrat opposition intends to keep up their dialogue with the East German communists. This, the opposition party hopes, will keep the doors open through which to slip messages urging for reforms. Referring to the change of guards in East Berlin, Social Democrat leader Hans-Jochen Vogel warned of over-expectations and of illusions, yet he believes in the need for maintaining contacts between his party and the East German State Party. The GDR, the German Democratic Republic, he said, must change its political course drastically because
without the reform, and I refer to Mr. Gorbachev, who recommended reforms in a very clear-cut way to the leadership of the DDR. The situation will be even worse, the number of refugees will increase, and the violence, which is the violence of the police force, is not the real answer to the needs of the population of the DDR.
Mr. Vogel welcomed that there is a growing number of democratic-oriented opposition groups, among them the nucleus of a social democratic party. Mr. Vogel said there were no official contacts between the two parties yet, but there was a lot of sympathy here and solidarity with the feeble beginning.
We cannot act instead of these people, but we encourage them to go on peaceful but constant.
For the new rulers in East Berlin and the Communist State Party keeping them in power, the West German opposition leader had this urgent advice.
Go on, start with reforming your social system. It's not so much time left.
Many social democrats here see hardliner Krenz as a man for only a transition period. They believe that the real reformers are still behind the stage, standing by to take over in a year or two, but not sooner. Alfred Schroeder reporting from Bonn.
Who are these Germans heading west? Back to pictures and more details.
Anyone who has seen a television film of East Germans struggling to get over barriers to reach the West German embassy in Prague realizes the refugees are people determined to make something of their lives. And that is exactly what a West German study shows. Volker Runge, a sociology professor at Wuppertal University, calls them pioneer types. He says they are winners. Another expert, Christina Pratsch, says they have the qualities often associated with Germans. They are thrifty, industrious, ambitious. This, as she explains, does not always endear them to West Germans.
We found that some of them have problems, not so much in finding jobs and economic affairs, but the problems are finding friends.
The East Germans at times complain of the cold social climate in West Germany. They miss their friends and relations. But this is made up for them by the highest standard of living in the West. They oppose all regimentation and, unlike West Germans, avoid joining clubs. Joseph Fleming in Bonn.
Oh, yes, 1989. It's going to be remembered as quite a year, quite a happy year, I think, except for things that happened in Tiananmen Square earlier. This has been an amazing year as far as people getting together and just doing things they've dreamed about for a while. Germany, Soviet Union, and all these other places in Eastern Europe. Now, if anybody has a city in far Eastern Soviet Union, please call now, 632-6901, and we'll try to call that place. We just heard from the Beatles off that same Rarities record. Happiness is a Beatles Rarities record because you have all these neat songs. That's Selig Dich, I think is how you pronounce that. Maybe it's not, I don't know. It's in German, obviously. The Beatles honed their musicianship and became a real group in the opening years of the 60s by playing in the raunchy clubs of Hamburg, West Germany. They learned to speak the language, met longtime cohorts such as Klaus Voormann, and felt a certain affinity with the country, which isn't hard to feel. I can attest to that. A few years later, their career skyrocketed, and EMI easily persuaded them to recut the vocal tracks of two of their first big hits, I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You, in German for release specifically in that country. Although the first tune had been on the Something New album for years, until this Rarities record that I'm holding here in my hand, She Loves You, sung in German, had never been released by Capitol in the U.S. Maybe it was released by somebody else, I don't know. The song, once released here, is a low-quality, there you go, low-quality single on a small label. That's a rather cheap shot at another label, isn't it? Has been out of print for years and has never been released in the U.S. in stereo until now. So that was a rare moment there. Okay, 632-6901, good evening.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
First of all, it was Michael and Anthony.
Michael and Anthony. I'm sorry about that. I just sort of forgot, you know.
Okay, it's okay.
But for your information, it's now 10:45.
Yep.
Okay. You told me it was 10:15, so I'm just correcting you.
Okay.
It's 10:45. Now, do you have a city in the eastern part of the Soviet Union?
Sure do.
What's the name of it?
Vladivostok.
Uh-huh. You know, that even sounds familiar, but could you spell it for me?
V-L.
V as in Victor.
Yep.
L.
A-D.
A-D.
I-V.
I-V.
O-S.
O-S as in Sam?
Yep.
Okay.
T-O-K.
T-O-K. Okay, great.
And we want you to ask the guy, we want you to interrogate him, since that was the town that the Korean plane flew over before it was shot down.
That's the place, huh? Now that's why it sounds familiar. Okay, that's the place over there. Well, we'll see if Glasnost has spread its head over there as well. Hopefully it has.
Okay.
And we'll see if Korean Air can fly over there with impunity. Thanks for calling.
Okay.
632-6901 is our phone number, and according to the recently set clock, it's now 10:46. How nice to be informed. Good evening.
Yeah, okay.
Huh? I'm confused. Elaborate.
Very much. You have yourself a sparkling day, and get down.
It sounds like one of those machines calling me. oh, boy. Well, anyway. okay, all right, to Vladivostok we go then, I guess. It's no one else has come up with any other cities. I'll give you one more minute to do this. And while we're waiting for people to call 632-6901 and tell us the name of any other city in the eastern part of the Soviet Union, which, you know, Vladivostok, whatever, might not work, so we need backups. That's what we need. But while we're waiting for that, a check of my credit, if you will. It's important to do this kind of stuff sometimes.
Thank you for calling Shell's Action Line. You have reached our automated inquiry service. If you have a touchtone telephone and your account number available, we encourage you to use this service. If you wish, billing information, to report a lost or stolen card,
or an address to mail payments, press 1 now.
If you need other information, or you do not have a touch-tone telephone, please hold for a customer service agent.
There's two different women there. I can tell that. I'm not stupid. Okay, I'm going to hit a touch-tone since I do have a touch-tone.
Please select one of the following inquiries. For billing information, press 1. To report a lost card, press 2. To report a stolen card, press 3. For address to send payments, press 5.
Well, my card
is... To repeat the inquiry selection, press 6.
My card is not lost or stolen, so I'm going to ask for billing information.
Please enter your 9-digit account number followed by the star button on your telephone, or your 11-digit account number if it begins with 3020, followed by the star button.
Well, it doesn't begin with 3020 or whatever, so I'm going to enter my card number. I should be doing this in my own time, I realize, but there's only so many hours in the day.
Your account number is...
Oh, no. My account number is not being bandied about over public airwaves. Maybe it's a couple of digits.
5-4.
Okay.
One moment, please.
Sure. No problem.
$89. As of November 18th, your balance is $0.00. To repeat the automated inquiry service selection, press 8. To end this call, press 9. To speak to a customer service agent, press 0.
Oh, that's interesting. Someone appears to have paid my bill. What do I press to repeat that? 8?
Please select one of the following inquiries.
I'm going to see if one number up from mine is a card. Maybe it's also belongs to me.
To report a stolen card, press 3.
You can shortcut these things.
Your last billing date was October.
It's the same information.
1989.
Okay, that's pretty dull. Well, anyway, it's a bit of fun there. If you want to check your credit, you can do that. All kinds of things too. Okay. All right, let's see if anyone else has any information. Good evening.
Hi, I'm back.
Who's this?
This is Mike again.
Mike, are you the only person out there that knows anything about this?
Yeah.
Okay, well, what's the second city you have for us?
Khabarovsk.
All right, you're going to have to spell that one.
K-H.
Yeah.
A-B.
Yeah.
A-R.
Yeah.
O-V.
Yeah.
S-K.
S-K. Okay.
Are you going to have a talk show? I mean...
I'll talk about something. What do you want me to talk about?
Hear about the proposed military cutbacks?
Yeah, I was going to talk about that, in fact. They're 5% cut.
Yep.
That's pretty neat, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's supposedly a direct consequence of what's happening in Eastern Europe. And 5%, it's starting, you know. The cutback is starting, and the war budget might actually be cut back so that we can, you know, stop being a debtor nation.
Yeah, I have a friend here who has a few words to say to you.
Okay, hopefully they're nice words. But
they're nice words.
Let's hear the words.
Okay. Yeah, this is Anthony.
Hi, Anthony.
How you doing?
Okay.
Well, now, 5%, that's a start, and, you know, that they could probably get that if they cut out waste and such.
Yeah.
But don't you think that that's exactly what the Soviet Union wants to do and then eventually get NATO forces down?
Yeah, except you got to understand, their economy's hurting worse than ours.
Well, sure it is. I mean, they'd love that, but that's still, to get that, they want America out of Europe.
Yeah, but doesn't it appear the Soviet Union is also getting out of Europe?
Their troops haven't left.
Well, do you think those hundreds of thousands of people marching in various capitals are going to just say, never mind when the Soviet troops come in? I don't think so. I think it's gone way beyond that point.
They had 1 million people march in Tiananmen Square, and they ran them 7,000 over.
That is true, but don't forget, China is one huge country that doesn't have any surrounding neighbors that could exert pressure on them. For instance, East Germany was pressured by Hungary and Czechoslovakia and even Poland to a degree.
I'm not arguing at all. I think it's excellent, the Republic of Hungary. I mean, democracy, that's excellent. And in fact, it would even be better. Hungary might even try to go into the common market,
uh-huh,
which would make it more of a NATO ally.
Yeah.
And none of them have gone away from the Warsaw Pact. Or Comic-Con, that's like their version of the European community.
Uh-huh.
But all these East Germans going into West Germany, you know some of them have to be spies.
Sure, but I think it's kind of meaningless at this point, you know. I don't know, don't you think it's possible that the Soviets have just gotten around to saying this is ridiculous. Let's just stop acting like enemies all the time and try to like accomplish something together.
Sure, you get a lot more accomplished with honey than vinegar.
Uh huh.
But I think that's their plan. They get us confident with them and get them spending less on their military. Then they would have to, they can reduce their military, but their people are still there in those countries, and they're still allies, the countries are. So I think it would be ridiculous for us to see them as less of a threat. They're a more congenial threat.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that as we continue on, that keep cutting the defense budget would be good. I don't know, 5% now is good, and then 3 years from now, another 5%, and then 3 years. I mean, we only have $2 million right now.
Well, look at this. $180 billion is what they're talking about. That's 5%. I can't even fathom what the actual budget is. It's
probably fill up, if that was $1 bills, I'd probably fill up my room I'm in now.
It's pretty sick when you think of it. I mean, on both sides, of course, the proportion spent on defense, and defense is really not the right word for it anymore because it's gone way beyond defense. It's like creative, offensive stuff at this point on both sides. So anything to cut back on that is bound to do some good. And I just don't see how continuing along this line is going to. I mean, remember a few years ago we were talking about nuclear annihilation as it was a fact of life, and now we seem to have finally moved away from that a little bit. And I'm for anything that continues along that line, and if it involves a bit of trust on our side, I don't think a 5% cut is going to cripple the nation.
No, and I'm not saying that either. I mean, if anything, that's going to put more pressure on the military to, tighten their belts.
Uh-huh.
Usually, the military inevitably uses that as, okay, no more raises for the people. And the rest of the money goes toward, the technology, the inventions that they come up with. And, mm-hmm. Like the stealth.
Yeah.
And that's something that we have to keep in mind. The Star Wars thing.
Yeah,
that's considered apart from the military budget. That's getting a lot of money in some of our very best scientists, and there's no telling what's happening there. So I think that if they start cutting that, we're actually cutting down the technological developments that have come up in the last few years that have benefited the whole American society.
Uh-huh.
Technology.
So there's other things.
Comes up with.
Sorry.
The technology the military comes up with,
yeah,
filters into all the other.
Oh, sure, it does. I realize that, but there's other things that have been cut or eliminated directly as a result of the military needing all this money, including things like education and human services. And it's about time, before this country completely falls apart. It's time that we started putting some more money back into that kind of thing.
Oh, I think we need to have more faith in the American public and the morals than to think we're completely falling apart. I don't think so at all.
Well, as a group of people, perhaps not, but as an economic system, I think we're well on the way. It's the whole thing is in a pretty pitiful state right now. I mean, look at how much money we owe. In fact, I'll get to this a little later on with the Japanese and everything like that. But it's just in a few short years, the situation has turned around completely.
Well, just think how much money we are bringing in. The deficit has been the lowest in 3 years, I think. I mean, we're bringing in a lot of money, foreign money, into this country.
Uh-huh.
And I think that if we look at it, what we owe isn't necessarily that bad compared to what we're bringing in.
Well, compare it to 10 years ago, when I believe we didn't owe anything.
Oh, no, that's not true. We've always owed. I mean, a country inherently owes money. I think that's the way the banking system kind of operates, and it's impossible to operate a country without owing money, somebody money.
Yeah, but I think more countries owed us money, and it sort of...
They owed us a lot. Yeah, well, we were coming out of, not 10 years ago, but let's say 30 years ago, coming out of World War II, yeah, of course. But then again, coming out of World War II, we were in big-time debt considering that time, because
mm-hmm.
we just didn't come up with the money, arbitrarily, that we were still on the gold standard and all that kind of good stuff.
You know what gets me, talking about funds and everything like that, this pay increase,
For?
To raise the lawmaker's salary.
Well, that, yeah,
by more than a third. And this coming, less than a week or 2 weeks after after they finally get the legislation through to raise the minimum wage for the first time in what, 8 or 9 years?
Yep.
By a few pennies?
Yeah.
I mean, where do these people come off doing this? I think their
compromise
wage, their wage increase should reflect the wage increase of the minimum wage. Why not? I mean, in fact, it should be the minimum wage as far as I'm concerned. If you really love your country, it won't bother you that much. But it's an insult, you know? It's an insult to people to treat them that way.
Oh, well, wait a minute. The representatives are there representing all those people. I mean, if they got enough letters, in a heartbeat, they would change their minds and vote whatever, you know, was lobbied for. Obviously, they're not getting too much pressure. They bend with the wind real quick. And I don't know if you've been to Washington lately, or in up here, it's pretty expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not cheap to be. A lot of money comes out of their own pockets to be a congressman or.
For some reason, I've really haven't noticed poor people lobbying all that much. It just doesn't seem to happen, you know.
Well, they have groups to lobby. I'm sure there are.
Yeah. Well, I wish there were more.
Well,
there should be some more pressure put on them for this, because what they proposed a couple of weeks ago is just, it's crazy. Nobody can live on that kind of money.
Well, you're not supposed to. I think that's just for minimum wage. Mostly deals with part-time jobs, don't they?
Well, it's used to take advantage of lots of people, and in fact, lots of people get less than minimum wage. You know, but it's something that should be watched a bit more closely, I think.
Well, and that would be.
Sorry?
I was trying to think, should it be the government's duty to watch it, or should it be more of a private citizens group?
Combination, really. I mean,
because the more government we get into it, the more bureaucracy.
I know. We should avoid that. But
yeah.
As long as the government is dictating what a minimum wage is, you know, maybe minimum wage should be done by the state. Do you ever think of that? Maybe it shouldn't be federal.
State by state?
Yeah, why not?
Well,
why is that a federal law anyway?
That would be state. I think, I don't know, who was minimum wage? Roosevelt?
Got me on that one. I don't think I have that in front of me. But it sure wasn't Reagan, I can tell you that. Didn't go up once in his entire administration. I mean, that's something I'm sure he points to with pride. But
Come on, Reagan did a lot for the nation right now.
Sure, he drove us into fear on many different fronts.
How long did Poland to do what it did?
Look, do you honestly think that Reagan is responsible for what's happening in Eastern Europe? I think it's the people in Eastern Europe that finally said enough already. You know, get off our backs. We're going to go into the streets and demand change.
I think that's true, but I think that Reagan's policy of we're going to support you, we're going to be there, and Bush's continuation really, really helped. Congress was right behind him on a lot of that.
Well, I don't know. I think no matter who is in charge in the White House, if crowds of people want something, they'll get it no matter where they are. You
okay,
know?
Wait a minute. Here's
I mean, it happened in Iran, didn't it? And that wasn't exactly going with our will.
Okay. Well, hey, we're gonna call back if nobody else talks to you.
Okay. Well, we got a line of calls here.
Okay.
So,
have a good one.
Okay.
Bye.
632-6901. Let's see who's on the line here. Who's on the line there?
Hello?
Yeah. Who's this? Hey, David, how are you?
What's going on?
I just noticed your special line that we had installed for you was ringing. David is an expert on something. I asked him to call into the program to talk about a particular subject, but we haven't gotten to the subject yet, so let me quickly go to the subject, if I can find what it was I was going to read. Well, while I'm looking for that, David, how are you? Tell us exactly how you are.
You mean, okay, I didn't realize, I just let the phone ring. I didn't realize that I was going to be on. I didn't get anything prepared.
So
I'm
not that David showed up.
I'm back from the movies. Why don't you go look for what you're looking for, and I'm going to look.
I'm still looking. You know, it's amazing, isn't it, how you can suddenly lose something that you pulled. And
about the magazine article, or the newspaper article,
yeah,
or the advertisement, rather.
Don't give it away. Ah, there it is. Thank you. Somehow it flew over to the other side of the room. Okay, this is the advertisement that appeared last week, or this week sometime, in the Port Jefferson Record. Yes, that's one of the local. Did I detect a sort of hush in the room when I said that? Okay, it's a local newspaper that comes out every week. And this advertisement appeared in it. Advertisement from Ralph Oldsmobile of Smithtown. And this is really amazing, so folks, listen to this. Big letters, big letters, it says, Japanese by Rockefeller Center, Will Rockville Center be next? Fact. And in big black headlines here or whatever.
Reverse.
Reverse print, thank you. It's good to have graphic artists hanging around here. Fact.
We used to work with said paper.
Every time you buy a Japanese car, your money goes to Japan to help them buy another part of our country. And then underneath that it says, help keep America American. Buy an Oldsmobile. Ralph Oldsmobile, Smithtown. Now, I don't know about you, but that really rubs me the wrong way. That's the most nationalistic, racist kind of thing I've ever seen in a newspaper like this. It's calling upon people to say, you know, hey, you buy a Japanese car, you're anti-American. Now, why do people buy Japanese cars? I mean, I'd love to hear from people that have bought Japanese cars. I've owned, in my time, God, what is it, 3 American cars, a Japanese car, and a Korean car. And believe me, folks, those three or four American cars that I had were terrible. I mean, they were awful. I got something like 12 miles to the gallon, those damn things. Japanese cars are more efficient. They work better, you know? Now, that's why people buy them. They don't buy them because they're anti-American. They buy them because they work and they're cheaper and, you know, what's wrong with that? Why don't we get our act together if we're going to start complaining about this kind of thing? Now, I don't know. I really don't like the fact that organizations like Ralph Oldsmobile are doing this, you know, getting on people's nationalism and racist kind of, you know, feelings that are sort of hidden in all of us. And I wonder if folks can tell me, did any other newspaper run this? Was it just the Port Jefferson Record? But it's not even called the Port Jefferson Record anymore, is it? It's like the Record Newspaper Empire or something. So I'd like to know what people have seen. And David, you're on the line.
Yes, I'm on the line.
Okay, I've asked David to call in because he understands all this economic stuff that I'll never understand. What is going on with these Japanese anyway? I mean, it seems like we're hearing an awful lot of this recently with people complaining that the Japanese aren't playing fair, they're buying too much, they have too much money, they're doing too well, and their products are too much better than ours. What's your opinion of all this?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm such an expert, but I mean, I have my own opinions. I don't think it's a question of the Japanese products being better, just, you know, as it were. I think that it's more a question of what people want. I mean, the United States doesn't have a single manufacturer of VCR equipment. Now, simply by virtue of that, we're going to be buying a lot of equipment from the Japanese as we buy our VCRs and cameras and televisions and all the other things that either are not produced here or are produced here in such tiny numbers that they couldn't possibly fulfill the demand.
Okay, so you're saying that it's impossible to buy an American VCR, in other words.
I'm using one example, but that has a great deal to do with it. I mean, if Japanese imports were suddenly curtailed to the United States,
uh-huh.
We'd find ourselves unable to provide for the consumer demand for lots of products,
well,
most mainly consumer products, but other things as well.
Do you think a lot of people, or any people, really want that to happen, for Japanese imports to be curtailed? Do you sense a mood that's, you know...
Nobody would put it quite in those terms. Let's stop Japanese imports and let's, you know, stop watching TV or buying new TVs and let's have all, you know, American cars that whatever don't work or whatever. And like you were saying, not necessarily true, but it's a strong feeling. I don't think anybody would say it like that. No, they would want to tax the hell out of the Japanese products. They would want to stop them from competing unfairly. They would want the Japanese government to stop funding Japanese industry. I mean, that's another very big problem that people have, that Americans have, with what's going on. They say that the reason that the Japanese are taking over our markets for consumer goods is because the Japanese government is funding private industry.
Well, why doesn't our government do the same thing?
Well, I mean, a perfect example is HDTV. You've probably heard about that, the high-definition television.
Right.
The Japanese government is spending billions and billions of dollars on research,
uh-huh.
And the beneficiaries of that is going to be the privately held Japanese companies. Now, there was quite a big movement on Capitol Hill to catch up, so to speak, with what they've already developed. And the president this week, in signing the bill, ensured that there would not be any money going from the government to private development, research and development, I should say, of HDTV. So any American company that wants to develop HDTV is going to have to do it on their own.
Interesting. Now, why don't we do the same thing, though?
I have no idea.
I mean, does that go against some kind of American economical system to fund private companies from the government?
Not that I know of. I mean, I think that you'd find a lot of people, especially the left-wing liberal groups would be really aggravated about this. I mean, it's the same thing. There'd be a big hue and cry over something like that. They'd say, they're letting people starving. There's homeless people all over. And the government has the audacity to give General Electric or some other large multinational corporation hundreds of thousands of dollars in tax breaks, billions of dollars, so that they can develop something like high-definition television and they can make money off of it? How dare the government give money to General Electric or one of the other large corporations? How dare they? I mean, you'd hear Ralph Nader screaming about it.
Well, he's good at that. But let me ask you this. Are there homeless people in Japan?
From what I understand, no, but I've never been in Japan.
Okay, why is that? Why are there any homeless people? Have they made it illegal or something? Or do they maybe take care of their homeless people, and thus they have money left over to invest in this kind of thing?
Culturally, it's different.
Uh-huh. Of course.
But don't have people in the United States living in cubicles that are literally large enough to hold a bed and nothing else. I don't know if you've seen the reports.
David, you live in New York City. You know that's not
true. When I say cubicles, I mean they live in cubicles. They walk down the hall. They climb up a ladder. They open up a door that's about 4 or 5 feet high. And the cubicle is literally 10 feet long, 4 or 5 feet high, and 7 or 8 feet wide.
That's amazing, you know, because I read that in a book called Neuromancer. And that's exactly how they described it. I think it was in Japan, in fact. I didn't realize he was actually talking about something that really existed.
Oh, yes, it does. It's for the middle management of many of those large, they're called zaibatsu, what we would call a multinational corporation.
Okay, well, as you said, though, it's a different culture, and apparently the people have accepted this.
Yeah.
We wouldn't accept it here, but surely there must be some way. Now, what I think it all is, how much money do the Japanese spend on military?
Well, compared to us, you know, you have to look at those numbers. You can't look at them in absolute dollar amounts.
Uh-huh.
You have to look at them as a percentage.
Percentage-wise.
I have no idea what the percentage is, but I know that we spend a larger percentage of GMP on defense than they do.
Probably a substantially larger, would you say?
Probably.
Yeah, I think that's what it boils down to here. You can't have both. You can't have economic prosperity. You can't have educational priorities, and you can't spend billions and billions on, or trillions in our case, on defense or, you know, just military in general.
A lot of the money that we spend on defense goes to defend the Pacific Rim in Japan.
Uh-huh. Well, a lot of people in Japan would say that that's, you know, that's not necessarily true. I mean, yeah, we're sending money, we're sending people there, but are they really wanted? Are they really needed?
Well, I mean, it's all part of the World War II. Win World War II.
But
people seem to forget that we won World War II.
It's getting ridiculous, so when is World War II going to end?
Well, I mean, do you want Japan to remilitarize?
I don't think they will. I really don't think they will, and I don't think they could.
Look, there's a lot of people that believe that it would be a dangerous thing. A lot of people don't want the wall coming down in East Germany. They think that that's the first step to a unified Germany, which is the first step to a Third World War.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah,
I agree, but there are people that believe that a reunified Germany or a remilitarized Japan would be very dangerous.
Why does Germany? I was thinking about this week. Why does Germany have to reunify? I mean, what language do they speak in Austria? They speak German. It's another German state. They're not unified, so why can't East Germany be another German state?
Well,
you know, they don't have to reunify just because they don't have a wall anymore.
I'm not so sure they want to reunify.
I don't think they do either.
It would be a tremendous burden on the West Germans.
Yeah, it certainly would. And the East Germans aren't all that happy about it either. And the people streaming over, that's not what they're talking about. They just want to see what it's like. They just want to interact more.
Yeah, I think it was a brilliant idea on the part of the East Germans to knock down the wall.
Uh-huh.
It's the old grass is always greener story. You know, when the wall is there and all they hear is stories about how wonderful life is on the other side of the wall,
right.
They think that you'd come to the United States or West Germany and it's paradise. You don't have to work. You have lots of money. You have beautiful apartments and TVs and cars.
It seems like such common sense, doesn't it, to just do that. And, you know, if you give people the freedom to leave, they'll come back.
Yeah, they'll see that it isn't such a hot place to be.
And the people that came back said, you know, I had no idea things were so expensive over there. And they, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, maybe I'll work over there and live over here because the benefits are better over here. So they're realizing that there's a trade-off, you know.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing about taking down the wall is, just in terms of a human rights standpoint, and you hear the the heartbreaking stories of brothers who were separated by the wall. One had one farm on one side of the wall and a farm on the other side of the wall, and didn't see each other for 28 years, and the stories of families that, you know, just innocent people just being separated.
Well, first of all, I don't understand how that's possible, because any West German can easily go to East Berlin. Easily. You know, it's there are many crossing points. I mean, before the wall came down, there were many crossing points. So, you know, I see people being separated, but I don't see why they couldn't visit. You know, it's also easy for East Berlin to go to West Berlin for the most part back then.
Well, you were there. I wasn't. I'm not familiar with the demographics and the actual geography, so you might be right about
that. That was a big pain in the ass, no question about that. But, you know, it wasn't an insurmountable thing.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you believed in things like that, then in which case you were really the one building your own wall, I suppose. But David, let me just ask you one other thing, because I want to take some phone calls here. What do you think this advertisement that I read? Do you think that's something we're going to be seeing more of?
I don't know if we're necessarily going to be seeing more of that kind of advertisement, but I know that there is a growing sentiment within the country. I think that some things like that have been going on much more in other parts of the country. I was participating in a nationwide computer forum recently. It was actually a few months ago.
Uh-huh.
And most of the participants were not from the New York area. They weren't even from the East Coast. It seemed like most of the participants were from the Midwest. And there was quite a chain going on of discussion, discussing just that, where you had one group of people who really felt that it was a threat. They were taking over the country. They were not going to do it by military means. They were going to do it by economic means. And there was another group that was disagreeing. It's you know, right and left again. It's the liberals versus the conservatives. An interesting thing, though, that people have brought up. I read an interesting story recently. To sum it up, in defense of the Japanese, I would have to probably say. The point of the article was that it doesn't seem like such a bad deal. What's happening? They're sending us products that we're using every day, TVs, VCRs, cars, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
They're giving them paper, American dollars, but it's paper. We're not giving them any product, any value in a Marxist sense. There's no value going over there.
Uh-huh.
Well, now they've got all these dollars stacked up. What are they doing with these dollars? They're buying property. They're buying buildings. They're building plants. They're building Honda factories in the South and in the Midwest.
Right, and they're employing American people, I assume.
Employing American people. Now, all right, they bought Rockefeller Center. Okay, what happens now? They don't pick it up and carry it back to Japan with them. We still have Rockefeller Center. We have all of our TVs and VCRs, and they've got the title deed.
Uh-huh.
They can't take Rockefeller Center. They can't remove it.
That's true. I don't think it's going to make a substantial difference.
They're not
who
going
owns
to
it.
Decide that the ice skating rink is not a profitable thing, so mm-hmm. Let's build a big condo in this space.
Yeah, you know, it's part of the global village. What difference does it make if Japanese people own it or if American people own it? Odds are you're never going to meet either one of them.
And chances are they're not going to change any of the... People are worried, oh, the Christmas tree. What are they afraid? They're going to build a pagoda there? I mean, there's still going to be a Christmas tree there. There's still going to be the ice skating. You know.
Hey, December 4th, they're lighting it, and they delivered it yesterday.
Right.
So, yeah, that's you know, definitely true.
And the title deed isn't going to affect any tourist or person that works there life, from where I can see. I mean, it's not a great thing to happen.
Uh-huh.
There are other more complicated things that I don't understand involving, you know, the dollar and the rates of return and the power that they wield when they own a lot of real estate and the control of the banks when they own a lot of real estate, that apparently it's not quite so simple to say, well, we're getting their stereos and their VCRs and we're giving them a title deed, so everything's great. But it's also nothing to panic about from my point of view.
No, and I think that's what we're very good at here is panicking, whether it's about the Russians or about the Japanese or the Iranians. You know, we do tend to panic.
And hey, looking at it from Mr. Oldsmobile's point of view, it makes a great ad.
Sure it does. I read it on the air, didn't I? We're not a commercial station. So, yeah, congratulations to you for getting me to do that. But I don't know. I don't think that's the right way to go. And hopefully there won't be too many of these kind of hate ads going out, because that's really what it is. I mean, you know, I get hate out of that ad. You know, hate and nationalism and strong sense of protectionism and all that kind of crap. But anyway, listen, I want to thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
And thanks for offering your advice and your words of wisdom. And
it was nice talking to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. 632-6901. That's our telephone number. And you can call it if you're out of the area. You can put a 516 in front of it and just let us know what's on your mind. 632-6901. The program is Brain Damage, 18 minutes after 11 o'clock. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Yeah, it's interesting you note the racist element in Japanese bashing.
Uh-huh.
Because who do you think the biggest foreign investor in the United States is?
Well, I would hasten to guess Japan.
No, you're wrong.
Okay. All right, I was wrong. Who?
Great Britain.
Great Britain.
By about $30 billion.
Uh-huh.
And that's quite a lead, $30 billion. By far away, the greatest investor in America. And as a matter of fact, the biggest foreign owner of Manhattan, of big Manhattan properties, is Canada. And yet, you know, you won't see anybody burning a Canadian flag because they own a skyscraper in Manhattan. I was just reading that in the New York Times.
So why do you think it is? You think it's because they look different, or?
I think so. Any conflict between out-groups is always much more intense and violent.
Yeah, because you can't really tell a Canadian or a Brit from looking at them.
But that is indeed a fact. The Japanese this year just surpassed Holland as the second major investor in America.
Uh-huh.
It's only this year that they've actually surpassed the Dutch in money spent over here.
Uh-huh.
It's also interesting to note that if you were to say England or Ireland, some of the probably the most common car around is like a Ford Escort Fiesta type car. It's like English Ford puts out, you know, and that's owned by an American company. And I know when I was over there in around 81, there was a hell of a lot of little Ford Fiestas and Escorts on the road. I think it was probably the biggest selling car over there. And the same is like in Australia, too. You know, Ford owns a lot. You know, we own a lot of the world. It's only like recently that, you know, people have actually been buying into us.
That's true.
We're still number one in like absolute economic terms.
Yeah, but, you know, I think if we just cut down on all this, you know, paranoia just a little bit, you know, we don't have to eliminate, you know, military spending, but I think a 5% cut is certainly a good start.
I think they could even cut some more.
Oh, sure. And, you know, if they put that money into the things that are really important, like education and, you know, making sure people aren't sleeping on the street and all that kind of thing.
It's true. I think within a couple of years we'll hopefully see a major relaxation in, you know, our military posture. And the Russians, too, hopefully. And we both really cut back to something more realistic than what we're spending now.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
It is a great train.
Sorry?
Before that guy was talking about how military technology has great spin-offs into the civilian economy.
Right.
Now, I would have to dispute that. And that that's probably the main reason there are no research and development funds available for the civilian sector, is that it's going to research and development Star Wars and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And that's definitely one of the reasons we can't compete. That's where that money's all going. Like right now, you see how Grumman's about to flounder with the F-14. You know, I just seen a thing in the paper the other day that American Airlines had to buy jet planes from Saab, because there's no American jets made in that class, because everybody's too busy building fighter planes.
That's something. Now, you know, and everybody says, of course, if Grumman goes under, all these jobs will be lost. Why don't we just reassign the people and have them build something we really need?
Grumman should have thought of that a while ago.
Yeah, well, they did with the buses, but that didn't quite work out, did it?
It was a fiasco. The flexible bus. Talking
sure.
About that?
A little too flexible, I think it was.
Disaster, I remember that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
it's something. I think it's good that the wall's coming down. Maybe the whole thing will come down soon.
The war is ending, I hope. I sure hope so.
I think it is.
It's about bloody time. Thanks very much for calling, sir. Our number is 632-6901, and speaking of the Soviet Union, let's do what we said we were going to do and give them a call. First of all, let's find out what the city code for Vladivostok is. For that, we will need to get to the AT&T operator. And for that, we have to go through the New York telephone operator, who are still on strike. Will you answer that damn phone? Used to be operators would answer the phone on the first ring. What the hell's
New York operator, Tim, can I help you?
Yes, hello. Would you please get me the AT&T operator, please?
Sure, hold, please.
Thank you. Twit.
One moment for an operator who can assist you. Thank you.
I love operator bashing. Some people like Japan bashing. I like operator bashing.
AT&T?
Ah, yes. Hi, I need a city code, please, in the Soviet Union.
I have to connect you, try to get the operator for you.
Okay, I understand I can dial direct now.
What, to Russia?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it's...
What?
I think it started only a couple of days ago.
You could dial to Russia?
Uh-huh, that's what I heard.
United States?
Yeah. Country code 7.
Oh, I wasn't told that.
Boy, typical.
All the calls are still coming here for the special operator. And I don't have a line to her. Hold on.
See what we have to deal with.
All circuits are busy now.
The circuits are busy.
Okay. So you don't have any information there?
No. If you know that it is, did you try it?
Well, you see, I need a city code. I don't know what the city code. I know the country code, but I don't know the city code.
No, I didn't get that.
Yeah.
So okay. What city do you have?
It's Vladivostok. Would you like me to spell that?
Starts with a W?
It starts with a V.
V what?
V-L-A-D as in dog, I-V-O-S-T-O-K.
Vladivostok. Hold on.
Thank you. Oh, boy. Well, I'll reserve comment on this till we see how it turns out. 632-6901. Oh, I'm not this again. She seems to like those tones. 632-6901 is our telephone number, and we're trying to ring a telephone number in the Soviet Union because this is the first time we can do it directly without operator assistance or lack thereof. Okay. If anyone
there are no lines at all.
No lines at all. Okay, well, thanks anyway.
Oh, but you sure they told you that? They didn't tell us that.
Well, that's what I heard.
They're still come. Well, how did you hear it? From who?
I heard it from a different operator, actually. So apparently they're telling some operators, but not all the operators, I guess. I'm not sure.
Well, if they were dialing, then they wouldn't be coming through here.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Okay, I'll try it later. Thanks. Actually, though, what I'll do is I'm going to try another operator. Because when something like this happens, you always try again immediately to see what the next operator says. Because undoubtedly, they'll say something completely different. First, though, we got to call the New York telephone operator. Wait for them to answer their phones.
New York telephone.
Yes, hi. Can I have AT&T, please?
Hold on.
Thank you.
One moment for an operator who can assist you. Thank you.
I hate that recording. Hopefully we won't get the same operator again. It does happen sometimes.
This is AT&T. Good evening, may I
do? Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could tell me, is it possible to call the Soviet Union directly now?
What city?
Vladivostok.
Moscow.
I'm sorry?
It's Moscow.
You can only call Moscow?
Yes, sir.
I see. Do you know what the city code in Moscow is? I assume she's looking for it and not just waiting for me to say something else. Of course, after a long period of silence, you have to wonder. Sitting here waiting with my pen to write down the city code of Moscow, yes.
One moment.
Okay. It's currently 27 minutes after 11 o'clock. Feel free to call us up. City code 516, and the number
Hello?
Is... Yeah. Yes. Sorry?
Hold on just a moment.
Okay. As I was saying, 516-632-6901.
Okay, Moscow, you dial 011.
Uh-huh.
7 plus 095 and 7 numbers.
Okay, you keep the 0?
095.
Okay, most countries you drop the zero, but here you don't?
No.
Okay. And do you have any idea when the rest of the Soviet Union will be added?
Don't, sir.
Okay, thanks anyway. Okay, so we know the... Oh, I forgot to ask what time it is in Moscow. You know, it's not going to do us much good if it's 5 in the morning or something. I don't want to wake them up. Oh, we'll just have to get them back again, won't we? Boy, what a pain this is turning out to be. Just want one little bit of information. We can't even call the other part. Why just one city? I don't understand that.
Okay, from America?
Yes, can I have AT&T, please?
One moment for an operator who can assist you. Thank you.
Used to be they disconnected you. They have to play the recording now each time.
AT&T operator, may I help you?
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could tell me the time in Moscow, please.
One moment. I'll have to get the operator from Moscow. Hold on.
No, not one of these again. She doesn't know it, but she has that information right at her console. She's going to get the doo-doo-doo thing again.
All circuits are busy now.
One moment.
Know what I mean. I know what I'm talking about here. This is...
All circuits are...
One moment, sir.
Since I know she's not going to get the information, I'm going to fade to some music and come right back as soon as I get the information. And please bear with us. 632-6901. This is part of the Roger Waters bit again from a record put out in 1970. You're going to hear that song called Breathe, which inspired the real song called Breathe, which appears on Dark Side of the Moon. Then we'll be back. 632-6901. Be afraid to care. Amazing. Roger Waters from a song that I just discovered, the first version of the song Breathe, which later appeared on Dark Side of the Moon. Actually, a completely different song appeared on Dark Side of the Moon with the same title, but also the same refrain, Breathe in the Air. It's currently 11:32, and we successfully managed to get through to an operator that figured out how to tell us the time in Moscow. It's 8:30 in the morning. Beautiful. No problem there. We can call them, and we won't have to worry about waking anybody up, unless they're calling somebody like me, and then they would have to worry about waking them up. But I don't think I'll have to worry about that. So let's see if we can actually call. Now, what number are we going to call? We know there's seven-digit numbers, and we know the city code is 095. We know the country code is 7. So what would be a good number to try? Well, why don't we try our number? That's right. Why don't we try calling 632-6901 in Moscow and see what we get. Probably make fools of ourselves, but that's part of glasnost, isn't it? The ring sounds like ours, doesn't it?
Your call cannot be completed as dialed.
It's MCI.
Please check the number and dial again.
Whoa.
Or call 1-800-888-1800 for assistance.
How did I get MCI?
213.
Choose MCI.
Your...
I want AT&T. Well, that's not fair. Let me try this again. Let's see. Country code, city code. Boy, that doesn't make any sense. I don't know why we get routed over there, and there's really nothing I can do about it. Our number, as I pointed out many times, is 632-6901. It looks like we're going to get that same recording again. Okay, if anyone knows a good number in Moscow, obviously we're going to have some trouble here. We just try a number at random. Just a different number and see what happens. Let's see. 685-1234. See where that gets us. Attempting to call Moscow direct for the first time in recorded history, we are allowed to do that. Actually, we used to be allowed to do that a long time ago. And then I think the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and we said, no more talking. Nope, that's definitely not a Soviet ring. Well, anyway. 632-6901. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi.
Turn on my radio.
Yeah, turn on your radio.
Hey, that, the ignorance of some of these people is just absolutely amazing when it comes to Japan.
Uh-huh. Well, which people are you referring to?
Well, the guy who said he doesn't know about homeless people. There are homeless people in Japan. I've seen them. I've been there.
Uh-huh.
You go in the train station, they have homeless people who live in the bathroom. Just like the Port Authority or just like Penn Station. They have homeless people. Some other things, too. They do have Hare Krishnas, too, in the train stations, which is pretty neat to find out.
Do they?
Yeah, but, let me see. I have wrote down some notes here. So I listened to this, and I know a little bit about Japan, so I'd like to educate these people if you possibly may.
Okay, go right ahead.
First thing...
Sir, are you on a cordless phone by chance?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I can tell. Okay, well, try to speak loudly, then.
Okay. One of the things in Japanese culture is they don't like to buy cheap things. They don't like to buy the second best. They only buy the best. If you go to Japan and you go out to a restaurant, they always have that thing about getting a $200 dinner or whatever. But if you do get that $200 dinner, it will be the best dinner you ever had. Japanese only like the best. They like top names, nothing, no shit, no garbage. Well, that's why they bought Rockefeller Center. It's a top name, Columbia Pictures or whatever. They're only buying the best. They don't want any of the cheap stuff. So obviously, when people see them buy all the best things, they're going to get jealous. You know, some of the other countries, you know, buying some of the lower bargain stuff, but the Japanese only want the best. So that's what they're doing now. And they're going through America and just picking the best of what they like. Okay? And that's a cultural thing. If you go to Japan, you look at the people, they drink the best scotch, they buy the best clothes. I was in Japan. I needed a shirt, just a shirt. And I couldn't find anything for less than $15 because they were all top name shirts, you know. Just a T-shirt, $15. So that's one thing people have to keep in mind. Another thing is that in Japan, business operates on a much more cooperative and benign footing with the government, while in the United States is very antagonistic. Business will see the government as their adversary, where in Japan it's your friend. Also, the banking laws are very liberal in Japan. A company can own stock, or a bank can own stock in a company, and that's not, you can't do that in the United States. So that way in Japan, if a company needs money, it's one of its shareholders will be a bank, and they will just give them money for to keep them going or whatever, and you can't do that in the United States. Say you want a regulation passed in Japan, well, the government and business will cooperate and work together to come up with a regulation that benefits everybody. Where in the United States, they will attack each other and try to iron something out. So these are some of the things why Japan can do what it can do, because they have better laws that work better for business. They have, their antitrust laws are not as strict as the United States. They have all the companies can cooperate. In the United States, we don't want that because we're afraid of what might happen. We have monopolies and things such as that. So these are some of the things. Well, if we want to change the way we operate, we can be just like the Japanese. But I don't think America is doing that bad. Japan has no natural resources. They import all their oil. They have no minerals to speak of. And the population is aging incredibly. I saw a statistic. Right now, they have 7 workers for every person on a pension or retired or whatever. Well, I think it's in 20 or 30 years or whatever, it's going to be 3-1. 3 workers for every person on Social Security or welfare or whatever. The population is not growing at all. I saw a World Bank statistic. In the next 50 years, Japan will only add like 8 million or 10 million people to its population. The United States will add maybe 100 million or so. So
what do you see the future is holding for Japan?
Well, right now, they're in a temporary position. They had a very good boost. The Reagan budget cuts did nothing but give Americans a lot of extra money so they could go buy the high ticket, the tax cuts. We had all this extra money, so we bought cars and all these things. So I'm not a real, they're going to always be a power. They're going to have a lot of money. But they have problems. They're going to start having problems, well, too. The children don't want to work as hard anymore. The cost of labor is too high in Japan.
Let me ask you something, though. They have a lot of money. They're only used to the best and everything like that. So why are there homeless people?
Why the homeless? It's a societal reason for that. Because every country has problems. So they have people go against the grain. In Japan, you respect your elders. It's because of the Confucian traditions, which came over from China. But you respect your elders. That's a very Asian thing to do. In the United States, you at 18, you say goodbye to your parents, you go off to college, and then, you come back for, Thanksgiving or Christmas, and that's it. In Japan, you might live with your parents because of the housing problems, and the housing is very, they don't have as good housing. I mean, here, we have homeless people, but, look how many people own their own homes here. Nice houses. I mean, Tokyo, I don't know if you've ever been to Tokyo. People living in, it's worse than New York. I mean, New York is pretty bad in itself in terms of housing, but Tokyo is a little bit worse. And people, every inch of property is taken up by something.
Mm-hmm.
So, the quality of life in Japan in certain respects, you look at the people living around here on Long Island, they have some nice houses. And you get your, even a half acre, and people think that's small, or a quarter acre. Hey, that's in Tokyo, that would be prime real estate, a quarter acre. You could, fit a couple of families on that. So Americans, they see themselves slipping and they get all worried. We always want to be number one. Well,
right.
Number two, in some things we're going to have to be number two. We can't be number one in everything.
That's a very good point. And it's a trade-off, isn't it?
Right. We have to pick the things that we want to be number one in. Right now we have the big gun in the world. And we're going to realize that if we want to have the big gun, then we can, have the best TVs.
That's a very good point. What do you think of advertisements like the one I read before?
That's ridiculous. It really is ridiculous that people can get away with that. But it appeals to a certain kind of sentiment in this country, the ignorant people who are they're being fed all this stuff about the Japanese. They need somebody to attack. Our traditional enemy, the Soviet Union, is no longer it's no longer the big, the ghost in the closet or whatever. It's, know, the Soviet Union has come down on us. The more friendly, you know, we have all these exchanges now with the Soviet Union. We're sending over rock bands and Coca-Cola and Pizza Hut. And, you know, so they're becoming more like us.
And in spite of that, they're still friendly to us.
I mean, enemies, right? America needs that. It's something to drive it, to keep it going, or else people here get very complacent. And with this, now with Japan, we have something to attack. Oh, the Japanese are killing us, and they're killing us in a few things, but they're also, they're almost being too successful because now the cost of labor is so high in Japan is that the other NICs, or the newly industrialized countries in that area, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, I don't think Singapore is one, but Thailand, those little countries in there, little dragons, can now just undercut the Japanese in price in terms of labor. If you're looking at Korea now, you get the Hyundai or whatever it is, Gold Star, you suddenly get products come out of Korea now because it's cheaper. Thailand, that was funny. I was looking at I had a clipboard and it said made in Japan. I don't think that was, I got it like 10 years ago. I don't think you would see that anymore because they can't make that cheap stuff anymore like they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Because the cost of labor is so high. It's so expensive to live in Japan. So they're almost, you know, this own success is going to kill them. You know, give them. We'll see how they are in 20 years. It's a temporary. I think it's temporary.
But at the same time, look at our country. Look at our, you know, everyday things.
We have more strength than they do.
If we didn't have any Japanese imports, where would we be now? You know,
that'd be incredible.
Probably a lot like East Germany, I think.
Well, if we didn't have any Japanese imports,
mm-hmm. We'd have a lot of inefficient, bulky things, I think.
Well.
It's like
you make some good stuff too. I mean,
oh yeah, but I don't think it's enough proportionally to how big we are. I know when we put some kind of a tariff on chips a couple of years ago, you know, the kind you put in computers, and yeah, it was a great idea, you know, it was to protect our economy and everything like that. The only trouble was nobody in this country made the chips, so there was a chip shortage that we imposed upon ourselves,
right.
And that had to have hurt us in the long run.
Yes. Well. Something like that, you know. Just in that case, with the chips, the Japanese, I think they were undercutting the market. They were dumping in that case, which the Japanese have a traditional long-term view in business, that they will go for the long term. They will undercut price, take a loss in the beginning, take market share. And then once they get market share, then they'll raise the price. And that's how they operate. They take a long-term view. People in the United States have this TV mentality. They want everything in 30-second, clips. I mean, they like everything short, fast, and you can't have that anymore. You need to look at things in a long term, okay, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years. You got to start thinking like that in this country, and people don't want to think like that. As soon as people start thinking like that, then we're not going to have any more problems with education and drugs and all these things, because people have a long-term view and they won't go for these immediate things that are pleasurable for the immediacy, but in the long run hurt us.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one more question. How long ago were you in Japan?
I was there 4 months ago on my way back from China.
Oh, really? How'd you find China?
Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, it's quite a place.
Yeah. But it's a whole other story and a whole other show, I guess.
Just tell me, what period were you in China for?
I left right after Tiananmen.
So you were there for Tiananmen?
Yeah, and that's a whole other thing with the... This, I tell you something, the media has really changed that story around from what really happened. I mean, the best thing, advice I can give to you is to go back and read the newspapers very carefully and see what happened. And you will see that those pictures of the students and the hunger strikes and everything are very moving, and you can get caught up in that. I'll tell you the perfect analogy is, if you look at San Francisco and the earthquake, and they showed pictures of the bridge collapsed and things like that happening, okay? But that was only a small part of what happened. Those TV cameras cannot capture the entire picture. And unfortunately, the bridge collapse, collapsed bridge, whatever that was, the interstate, came to symbolize what happened in San Francisco when really 95 or 99% of the city was still running and functioning and still intact. And I think that's what you have to do, is that the TV camera is so distort. I hate TV. I don't watch it anymore.
Well, a lot of times the story is written before the investigation begins with TV. That's, you know, they know what they're going to say beforehand. Can you just give us a very brief indication of how it was different, though?
Well, how it was different was why the people were there. They weren't there so much for, these people now who want to talk about this democracy wind sweeping across the nation, the world. Then there were people in China who want democracy. That's a given. But they were mainly the intellectuals and the students. But the general people that came out, okay, they were against corruption. It was more of an anti-government for them. The corruption and the inflation, which for a country which never had inflation was suddenly experiencing 30% inflation. That's a little bit hard for a lot of people to take. This whole thing about, people being run over by tanks in the square, nobody was killed in the square. People were killed outside the square.
Right, that was a technical thing at first. They in the square.
I caught an error. One of the great Newsday is another terror. Don't read Newsday. It's garbage. But anyway, in Newsday, they had an article about the people who threw. I'm just telling you little things that I picked up. The people who threw paint on Chairman Mao, and it says the crackdown continues, and it's all about how they were thrown in prison and their sentences and everything. And you. People would see that and say, oh, these are people who were, against the government and they were in the movement and everything. Well, there was an article from the New York Times right after that event happened, and the article Newsday was maybe a couple weeks after the crackdown or whatever. But the article in the Times was about how people were horrified that they were throwing paint on Mao, that he was their George Washington. I mean, people were wearing Mao buttons at the demonstrations. They had pictures of Zhou Enlai, the former premier. Mm-hmm. People had banners that said, we support the Communist Party. I mean, that's not really a pro-democracy movement. They're supporting the Communist Party. I mean, the people in East Germany are like,
right, it's
Communist Party, rip it down.
It's pro-change, not necessarily pro-West.
Right. Not the democracy we have it all gets down to semantics and the words. That the way they're using the word is much different from the way we imagine it to be. And it's really difficult because the Oriental mind is so different, and you have to translate things into Chinese and Japanese or whatever. And they start to change the meaning of the word because their language is so strict in terms of what they have to work with, where we just can just create a word. They have to take words that they already have and change the meaning around. So their idea of democracy is a hell of a lot different from ours. I mean, if you look at this, the people in the square, they kicked somebody out, the guy Wu Erkaishi, who's now the leader of the exile, the pro-democracy movement. Well, he was kicked out of the movement because he wanted to leave the square. They said, no, we can't leave the square, and they kicked him out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody dissents from the popular opinion and you kick him out of a movement. I mean, granted, in revolutions, you're going to have excesses.
Right.
And maybe, I don't know if it was a revolution, but it's a very confusing thing, and the thing in the papers that people have, picked up on certain themes, and they haven't looked at it and said, really, is this what happened? 2,000 people died. Now they're reevaluating it and say maybe several hundred, and with thousands injured. I mean, still, it's a catastrophe. It was a horrible event that a government would have to use its army against its own people. But I'm saying is that people have to look at things differently and not accept anything. And when they look at things, and be very cautious about what they do accept, or Japan, or United States, or anything. That's why, this guy came over, another liberal conservative thing. No, it's basically just, two people with set ideologies looking at things, and not people who are in the middle saying, I don't believe either of you people. I want, get right at the truth. I'm not going to accept either a leftist or a rightist interpretation. And go, say, I'll accept whatever the truth is. And it was very confusing, and I was there and I saw it, and I didn't understand it at the time, and I still don't understand it, and it's very difficult for me to understand it now.
But you did learn something important about the media and everything like that. Yeah, that goes on all the time, What the media says usually has very little reflection of what's actually going on.
I mean, these people, I saw the place where they stayed at the you know, these people from ABC. The news, the TV news people are really bad. They come in, you know, Dan Rather. Somebody hands them a press a brief.
Oh, yeah, right. I've seen this firsthand, of course. It's terrible. They have no conception of what's really happening.
Oh, he doesn't know what the hell's going on. They hand him a press briefing. He stays at a hotel.
What's more important, he doesn't really care what's going on.
He doesn't care. He's all cared about ratings, you know. That's all he cares about. They go in. He doesn't have anybody who speaks Chinese. You know, they rely on an interpreter. He has no idea. He has stupid questions. I've seen these people ask, you know.
Let me just say one thing, and then I want to move on because we're running out of time here.
Okay.
But I was actually in a TV studio a few weeks ago, and I found out, you know, when you see the guys before the cameras, well, before the newscast begins, they're jotting things down on pieces of paper, and you sort of wonder, well, what are they writing there? You know, are they writing notes about the story or things like that? No, no chance. They're writing, they're underlining words that they want to emphasize, so that their speech works, you know, in a powerful kind of way. They don't care what's written on a piece of paper, and you'd be amazed at how uninformed these people are, because I've seen it firsthand.
Dan,
they ask really stupid questions.
Does he ever write any of his stories? Does he ever investigate anything?
I don't know. I really don't think so.
Any schmuck off the street to read the news? Why don't we? I mean, why we? You know, you pay Dan Rather $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
How many reporters out in the, you know, in other countries could they support
on
that salary? A lot.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't turn it into a superstar kind of thing. A newscaster should be a newscaster. Nothing glamorous about that.
It should be anybody. I mean, seriously. I mean, I could do it. You could do it. You just have to read the news. You got somebody else writing it. I mean, you just have to have a pretty face. That's all it is.
It's true. We could just, you know, have a robot do it or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a joke. It's absolutely, the news, TV news is a joke. You could read, if they had the transcript from a TV news, you could read it in 15 minutes, 10 minutes.
Sure.
Post.
Well, if they would only devote some more time to the actual, stories, that would be nice, too. Listen, sir, I've got to move on, but thanks very much for calling.
All right.
All right, and keep watching the papers and tell us when something's wrong again.
All right, you got it.
Okay. 632-6901. We're running out of time. We'll try to get to the remaining calls, but first, something important that I wanted to pass along, something which made me very happy this week. Well, apart from Albanian folk music, was the fact that there was a huge article in the newspaper about Albania, finally. I mean, I've been waiting for years for an article like this, but finally it came on Monday, November 13th. Island in the Balkans. The headline reads, "No hint of change in Albania, where liberalization has long been suspect." Now, if you know Eastern Europe, Albania is the one country, it's a communist country, but it has nothing to do with the other communist countries in the area. They hate the Soviet Union, they hate all the other countries in the Eastern Bloc. They used to be allied with China, of all countries, and then they got into a fight with them in 1976, and since then they've been sort of an island, even though they're land bordered with Yugoslavia and Greece, and just across the Strait of Otranto, I believe it's called, from Italy, or the Adriatic Sea. They're just there. They're this very, very closed country, closed society. So here's this article with a picture, even, a picture of one of their squares, Skanderbeg Square, they call it. And they say the country has been unaffected by changes. The political and economic changes sweeping through much of the rest of Eastern Europe are having no visible effect here in this xenophobic, hardline communist nation, where for decades, even the Soviet Union has been regarded as a renegade and apostate from true communism. Liberalization has long been a suspect here, and though the door of tourism and commercial contacts has swung open a little as Albania seeks foreign currency, the convulsive changes rippling through East Germany, Hungary, and Poland seem very remote. Few Western journalists have been permitted to visit Albania since World War II. Recently, however, as Albanians have begun to encourage some limited tourism, they permitted a group of 22 European tourists, mostly Greeks, to enter the country for a closely supervised tour. This reporter is believed to be the first American journalist to visit Albania since the 1960s. The five-day visit was a journey back to the 1950s. Ox carts, donkeys, and rusting and rattling Czech trucks are the main means of transportation in the countryside. In the cities, people mostly walk or take decrepit buses. Bicycles are rare. Statues of Stalin and his Albanian disciple, the late Enver Hoxha, I believe I pronounced that right, statues of them abound in every town and village. Okay, all right. I'm going to have to fade this down because it's going to get distracting. In every town and village, billboards and signs glorify Mr. Haksha, I believe is how you pronounce it. Yes, something like that. He ruled Albania for four decades until his death in 1985. As celebrations get underway this month for the 45th anniversary of liberation from Italian and German occupation under the leadership of Mr. Haksha's communist partisans, Albania remains a quiet, rigidly controlled realm, seemingly untouched by the gales of change in the rest of Eastern Europe. There are no street protests or signs of opposition, even though Albania has the lowest standard of living in Europe. There is a ban on private cars, and consequently Tirana, the capital of 250,000 inhabitants, seems almost empty. Most desolate of all is the vast Skanderbeg Square at the center of town, where the city's one skyscraper, the 15-story Hotel Tirana, the Museum of National History, and the Palace of Culture look out on playing fountains. Throughout the visit, two government guides kept constant watch over the group, as no doubt did agents of the Sigurmi, they're the secret police, in places like the opera where I Pigliacci was performed, or at a disco where tangos were the only music. Albanians kept to themselves, and yet, from time to time, short and seemingly spontaneous encounters took place. One man approached to ask if the foreigners could provide him with a medicine for a skin condition. In the main department store, amid displays of drab clothing, a young Albanian suggested an immediate exchange of his wool trousers for a visitor's jeans. Others asked for razor blades, American cigarettes, or cosmetics, items that can be bought only for foreign currency in hotel shops. For the visitors, the only source of official information was Spiro Ilias, one of the guides who said he also worked as a legal consultant for the government. In his mid-40s and fluent in Greek, Mr. Ilias plied his captive audience with glowing accounts of the achievements of the regime. His frame of reference was the progress made since World War II, when Albania had been devastated by Italian and German occupiers, and before that, the 15-year feudal rule of the self-proclaimed King Zog. Yes. Well, to skip all the way to the end here, since this is a rather long article, if you do want to look at it, go to the Monday New York Times, Monday, November 13th, page A13. Last year, 46 refugees managed to get to Greece from Albania. According to Konstantinos Gigas, who heads the Northern Epirus Association in Athens, asked what would happen if Albania opened its borders, Mr. Gigas said even the turtles would run. Well, that's our show for tonight, folks. Sorry for those we didn't get to. We'll be back again next week with all kinds of fun and exciting stuff. Gosh, you know, what can I go out with? I guess I can go out with Albanian folk music.
No.
Yeah, why not? it's been fun. Keep tuned to WUSB in Stony Brook. Brain Damage will be back next week, 10 to 12. Take care.
Πατάτε κι ζωτή, οι ζωτή σαντελή, ας να γεννή κοκρδέ, με τα ρωσιν τρέπρτε, σάλες μητρίτες, ακεβέ και τεκές, σάλουλε μητομόρ, ακεδανε δινοβόρ, σαν τρασα μητσαρδάκ, ακενούσε με δούβακ, Salule mi cerși, a cetri van aștepti.
Hi, this is Diane with the Concert Billboard for Sunday, November 19th. Tonight, George Carlin will be at the Westbury Music Fair. Hungerthon 89 will be at the Lone Star Roadhouse with Southside Johnny, Dr. John, Mick Taylor, and others, and at the United Nations with Tom Chapin, Steve Chapin, and others. On Tuesday, the 21st, Nona Hendrix will be at SOB's. She'll also be there Wednesday, the 22nd.